One of the things I came across in the material that I looked at was apparently there was a problem on the rivers with periodic incursions into Cambodia. For example, there was one big issue where a PBR went across the border, was captured by the Cambodians, and this caused a great deal of difficulty for you because it involved the State Department and involved questions of, I guess, communist propaganda claiming that the boat and the crew had defected. And apparently this issue took about a month or 6 weeks to resolve, and it happened more than once, so I would like to hear your views on that.
When I first got to Vietnam, General Goodpaster, who was then the deputy to General Abrams, in my call on him, commented that a few weeks earlier, a Navy PBR had gotten into Cambodia, and he wondered whether adequate precautions were being taken to prevent it from happening again. I looked into it in great detail and sent a report to him in which I reported all the things that we were doing to make sure that it didn't happen again. And sure enough, it did happen again. The episode that you have referred to, we were supposed to have a patrol at the crossing back and forth at the river a mile or so from the border. We were supposed to have everybody instructed, the list of things that people were instructed to do was long and impressive, but sure enough, another fellow managed to do it. In the report that was made of that second episode, the one that happened, it did happen on my watch, the PBR had come alongside, I think it was the Benoit, which was a mother ship, and it may have been another ship, may have been an LST, and stayed an appreciable period of time, and during that period of time, the current in the river had changed because of the tide, and when the skipper of the PBR got back on the PBR, he left in the same direction relative to the ship that he thought was downstream, but he was actually going upstream, and then for some reason the patrol did not intercept him. That was running back and forth near the Cambodian border. And so everything went wrong and the guy got into Cambodia. It was an embarrassing episode. We didn't get an awful lot of flack from General Abrams, who seemed to understand these kind of operational things, but the State Department was very upset with the fact that this thing had gone amiss and that they had a problem dealing with it diplomatically. Mm-hmm. That's about as much as I remember about it.
When you first hear about this happening, how long did it take you to determine, or the command to determine, that this is actually accidental because the tide had turned?
Not very long before we got the first guess that that's what had happened, and then subsequently it was confirmed when the crew was retrieved. Mm-hmm. That's what did happen. But my recollection is that within a couple of hours, the local commander had reported that that's what their estimate was as to what had happened, and that it was not a defection.
So it was as a result of this, then, that, if I remember the message traveling correctly, that you then have to have a standard patrol near the border.
Yes.
Who will then stop every U.S. naval vessel or every vessel that has to be checked.
That's right.
Before it crosses the border, and say you are within 1 kilometer of the border, and they also put up signs to that effect.
That's right. So we did all those things after the fact, but there was supposed to be a patrol there based on the episode that had been reported to me. I don't recall whether or not the patrol just wasn't operating, or whether the river's fairly wide at that point, whether the PBR just got by the patrol. Mm-hmm. But we then did all those other things, including, it seems very silly, but posting signs on both banks.
And when this happened, did your command have that much to do with the resolution of it, or did this basically go beyond you to a higher level?
No.
Because of the implications?
No, that was left totally to me, because General Abrams did assume that it was ours. Mm-hmm. And he was very good about backing up his subordinate commanders and not trying to get into it himself.
Relative to, were you thinking about getting the captured crew back?
Actually, both, sir, yes. So.
Yeah, well, that was all the way up to Washington to do what was necessary between the State Department and the Pentagon. But that was sort of a separate problem from the problem of how do we see to it that this doesn't happen again.
Okay, so this is basically becomes two levels. Once
right.
it's a diplomatic incident, that part of it's out of your hands.
Right.
But it's up to you to determine why this happened and
right.
how to keep it from happening
That's
again.
Right.
Okay. And I suppose there was a constant risk of this sort of thing. Once you establish the Sea Lord's operation, some of the canals farther up, close to the border, there's a constant risk, I suppose, of you being that close to the border of a boat straying across or your forces coming into contact with perhaps Cambodians or the PKK, I think they were called. Or
right, and you know, I described the episode of where our son Elmo went into Cambodia to prove his old man wrong on
right.
the intelligence. That's the only one I recall of anything that reached that level. Do you recall any other?
Well, we had frequent at the morning briefings complain of the 139th incursion into Cambodia
yeah.
and things like
yeah.
that. And one morning I had to confess that I'd been up in one of the OE-10s and I've described that to Les, how just terribly difficult it is for that pilot trying to keep his eye on his forces that he's trying to support, where they're designating the enemy,
yeah.
where he's trying to attack. And of course the river at that area is the boundary,
yeah.
and he's doing a wing over in the dark and all sorts of things like that.
Even the boats, you know, they when they turn into a canal, they know that on the chart maybe 1,000 yards to the Cambodian border in some places, but they're winding around and how do you know where that border is?
So, right.
I'm just sure that there were more than one episode where our boats actually got into Cambodia.
So during the monsoon season, the characteristics of where the river and canals are changes greatly as the water
yeah.
rises 30 feet sometimes.
Because of that, then I suppose the signs and the patrols were limited to the major river, and that off in the canals, off onto the sidebar parts, you could easily, I suppose, become disoriented or
yes.
Yeah, but they did go into those narrow canals to lie in ambush.
Yes, sir. When the Sea Lord's strategy was established, when you came in and said we've got to take this frontal approach and take the interdiction all the way up to this level, was there any concern in your planning that hey, we're this close to the Cambodian border and then something has to be done to keep that in mind?
Yes, I was very conscious of it because of the fact that we'd been nicked twice by penetrations up the major river. And everybody knew that they were not to penetrate, and everybody knew that they therefore should be cautious about not getting right close to the border in those areas where they were in a narrow canal or river. But by the time of Sea Lords, I don't recall that it's something we worried about a lot at headquarters.
Well, your chief staff did when particularly we were going to leapfrog to small groups up in Giant Slingshot in that Parrots Peak area. We were starting a whole new operation. It was one thing that we raised the flag on that we're just going to have to be more careful. But you can't station a boat up there as a patrol because you got to fight your way up to that line anyhow. And it just, again, proves the responsibility that those young petty officers and junior officers had on their shoulders. And you relied on them and they didn't let you down.
The Van Cote and Van Cote Don rivers were both a little bit distant from the Cambodian border itself. The border was drawn. I don't think the rivers actually touched the border, did they?
I thought they did, but I'm probably wrong.
I know.
There were
it's something to look at on the chart. But in any event, I don't recall that we ever got they reported for a penetration in that area.
Mm-hmm.
It was a much more nervous thing in the early days than it was once we started operating along the border. The sort of the nature of the war had changed too, and it was obvious from General Abrams' demeanor that he wasn't all that concerned about the occasional penetration.
Mm-hmm. He was glad to see that the Navy was taking action.
Yeah.
And that if you're this close to that region, sticking your neck out that this is going to happen from time to time, and that's war, I suppose.
Right.
That's probably the attitude.
Right.
Getting back to what you said, I remember in some of the message traffic, some of the operations orders when the OB-10s were in support of some of the operations on the river, that they had standing orders along that part of the border that they must make an attack run from this direction, they must egress in that direction in order to avoid the border. But obviously, when the bullets are flying, when boats are under attack, that the pilots aren't going to play so hard.
That's right.
They're going to play a little fast and loose with the rules,
yeah,
as a matter of necessity.
Sure.
So.
And they're not going to report it if they think they got over the edge of it.
Right. Do you remember any of the details associated with, I saw a lot of this in the message traffic, a duffel bag program, as it was called, where sensors were placed near places like Seafloat.
Yes,
mm-hmm.
Yes. We did a lot of that, and I don't think much of that had been done before I got there, because we were so concerned about the fact that at one time we had an LST up the Vamco Tay River, until we were able to get logistic support ashore, and that was a lovely target. We not only had sensors out, but we also had the LST crew out cutting down the brush 2,000 yards in all directions.
Mm-hmm.
We also used sensors around each of the bases that we established, because we had just a handful of people there, and they could have been, if they were caught by surprise.
Mm-hmm.
So we did quite a bit of that once the Sea Lords campaign got, also at Seafloat.
Right. This sounds like a follow-on, I suppose, from the Air Force operation. They called it Igloo White, where
yeah,
they emplaced sensors along the Ho Chi Minh Trail,
right,
as a reference to bring in artillery or bring in tactical air to hit.
That's right.
These infiltration points. And so then, was this a conscious decision on the Navy to say, we've seen that this works along the Ho Chi Minh Trail, why don't we bring that into the canals?
Yeah.
Why don't we bring that into...
I remember coming back and asking that we get something done when I was briefed on what the Air Force was doing up north. The number two son, Jim, has a book that still hasn't been published called Iron Will, Bare Feet Iron Will, and it's based on a series of 80 or 90 interviews with the former enemy, and there's some fascinating stuff about how they tricked us on the Ho Chi Minh Trail, and the kinds of things that they did. What triggered that in my mind was, one of the things they did is they'd find a sensor and they'd leave it active but move it 10 miles away and let us drop bombs to beat hell or fire artillery to beat hell into an area where they weren't.
Mm-hmm.
You'd be interested in taking a look at that too.
Okay. I remember they're from the from looking at the documents, there apparently was an organization here, because some of the NAV4V files contain personnel rosters for the entire command, from yourself all the way on down to the lieutenant's junior grade,
right,
who, you know, and one of them was the duffel bag officer.
Right.
And I remember a bit of message traffic that you sent down to Seafloat, and the Seafloat file that said that the reaction time to this duffel bag intelligence was woefully inadequate, and that they need to step it up.
Right.
Because apparently there were some lapses as much as 30 to 40 minutes from the information coming into the sensor to when the rounds start hitting the deck.
Right.
And I remember the message said it needs to get down to 10 to 15. And I thought that was interesting, because I suppose that's a very problematic issue of expecting that maybe this is going to get results.
Yeah.
And how do you assess the results?
Thank you.
The pressure that you put on in a case like that
is
really designed, more than anything else, to make them aware of the need to get aroused and get action.
Mm-hmm.
And if they know that they have to react in 15 minutes, the skipper is probably going to have the word out, wake me as soon as you get a signal. And people are going to begin to man battle stations and so forth, so that they're at least going to be ready. That's what I worried about in terms of making the reaction time to fire back as brief as possible,
mm-hmm,
knowing that a lot of other actions that would have been taken in 1 minute, 2 minutes, and 3 minutes would improve readiness to deal with an attack.
Mm-hmm. And that was a very important point on these small groups I was talking about as we started up in the Van Cote and Van Cote d'Ong, as we got up into the narrower waters, and we just had maybe 10 or 12 men for them on barrels.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd have 10 or 12 55-gallon drums of fuel for the boats and then gallons of ammunition.
You've never seen such austere logistics as we had.
It really was. And those sensors just gave them a great deal of confidence and some support in depth where they couldn't get out and clear the jungle, but they had the sensors out, and they were standing by on watch around the clock on those.
Mm-hmm. It seemed from reading the material that most of the duffel bag sensors were associated with SeaFloat, because here you have an operation basically by itself down in some of the most remote parts of South Vietnam, and you're virtually surrounded.
I think the answer is the reason you saw traffic there is we were taking such a personal interest in that area, mm-hmm. that we were getting way into the tactical side of it, whereas up and down the river, these young bucks were doing it themselves. And we relied on them and counted on them to be doing it. SeaFloat was so isolated and so strategically important that we were getting way into the tactical side of the headquarters.
Mm-hmm. This question of SeaFloat brings up the issue in my mind where you talked about a couple of floating barges here and there with poor logistics, and this is where you're conducting operations. SeaFloat itself is made up of a number of these pontoon barges lashed together.
Right.
So were those barges already in place and were being used singly or in pairs here and there, and then your staff has the idea that we can put a number of these together?
Yes.
And so the asset was already there. It was just a question of putting it together.
A lot of these were built under Dick Nicholson's supervision in the shipyard in Saigon. I remember going down and inspecting them, and how some of these may have been modifications, but there was a lot of that we had to build virtually ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And now these were big floats. These were not just barges, but I would say the dimensions were smaller. I mean, they were just literally 2x12 barrels, like you'd have in your old lake swimming hole at home.
Almost like a little floating jetty,
right.
Sort of.
Okay. Right. And, three or four of those that would get you to the muddy bank, but it was a way for the PV, big operation.
And I think that 9 people out of 10 probably would have said it's infeasible to do what we were doing, but we just really counted on those youngsters to be able to improvise and make it work, and by golly, they did.
I tried to find the name of the four core zone commander who said that this is a disaster waiting to happen, but I couldn't find his name. It wasn't General Ewell that said that, was it?
No. General Ewell was very bold and aggressive himself and supported everything we did.
General Russell can tell you his name, because he's the one that told him to shut up.
Yeah.
Wish I'd known that when the general was in Lubbock. I could have asked him. But
I've got his address in Salem if you want it.
Okay. I could write him a letter and ask him about that.
He may decline, but it's worth asking.
Right. That was my disappointment with the message traffic. It never, or very rarely, gives names.
Yeah, it's all titles.
It's, yes, sir, it's titles or command structure or third person.
Right.
But it doesn't give names, and that leaves you with a sense of frustration.
Saying in the Navy, if your name's mentioned in dispatches, beware.
Oh, well, the Admiral gets mentioned when he goes to SeaFloat and whoever's with him. From time to time, it was someone from the State Department or the Defense Department or someone from higher up in the Navy. SyncPAC came once and saw it. And I suppose it was whoever was the commander of SeaFloat at that time had a sense of humor, because the message said something to the effect of Admiral Zumwalt and his party arrived at SeaFloat about 15:30 in the afternoon, received a briefing, did a walking tour of the annex, had an excellent SeaFloat steak dinner or something to that effect, and then had a peaceful night's sleep, stop. The MATSB fired H&I fire all night. a, a, a peaceful night's rest as we did H and I all night. So I thought that was funny. I'm not sure who the commander was at the time.
Dick Nicholson had a great sense of humor, and he knew the admiral personally, so he didn't hesitate to interject.
And he sent that up to his commander. I guess CTF-115 right. was the overall next up the chain.
Right.
I thought that was a great story. In addition to the duffel bag program, I also saw indications of a program where there was a single squadron of P-2s that operated out of, I think, Sangley Point in the Philippines, and they contained airborne sensors, airborne infrared, airborne radar, and they would fly over the Delta at night in patrol boxes, and they would survey the rivers electronically, and they would send down intelligence saying, you have movement here, you have a boat here, you have a combustion engine mm-hmm. here, and the fire would be brought down. And there wasn't much on that, but what there was, it seemed to be controversial, because on two occasions at least, these aircraft attacked PBRs.
Oh, really?
Yes, sir.
They were actually attacking as well as reporting them.
Mm-hmm. They were armed.
They call in fire.
Mm-hmm.
PB.
Yeah. That's what I thought.
Whoever they would report to that center would call in mm-hmm. fire.
So the P-2s did cause some of our units to be fired on. I'd forgotten that. Aaron, if you recall it.
I only have a vague recollection that they were working with us, that we had sensors in the Delta, and we were getting higher aircraft surveillance.
Yeah, I remember that.
Than we normally would. I can easily see how an OPCON center out in the Delta at Bentui or someplace like that that had control of and were supposed to know who was in the area. But a lot of times those seal ops, they didn't tell anybody where they were going.
Right.
Something like that, or another incursion.
You deal of that at Seafloat, the seal ops.
Right.
I suppose about half the message traffic were seal operations, that they would go out and looking for a Viet Cong tax collection cadre or something and go where they had heard them to be and look, and the results would be reported. But
we figured that was one of our most important defenses, because they being on the prowl really kept the Viet Cong from concentrating in that area.
Mm-hmm. They were apparently very clever in some of the ways they did this, because one of the reports I read, and this tended to happen a lot, was that the SEAL team would go in, they would search the area, they would look in these houses, they would question people, then they would leave, and it would be a false extraction. The helicopter would come and take half the team away, and the other half of the team would stay, and they would watch the trail, and the five or six of those that I read, it was never more than 20 or 30 minutes before the VC who took off on the helicopter showed up the first time came back.
Yeah.
And I thought that was amusing, but it seems that Seafloat, I don't know if it's possible to overstate the importance of this or the centrality of this during your time in Vietnam, but it seemed from the material that I read that this was almost an epicenter.
It was.
For a broad range of what was happening while you were coming for me.
We were, in essence, taking back a big section of the resource-richest area for the Delta that had just been written off.
Mm-hmm. I don't want to blow it out of proportion, so let me ask you, of the things that, or the strategies, including Sea Lord, Sea Float, some of the other things that happen while you're there, of those operations, which one would you regard as being the key one, the central one, that is the best example of how the strategy was put into action?
I guess what I'd have to say is that they were pretty co-equal. The Sea Lord's operation had the effect of so reducing logistics that we were able to reduce casualties to the Army and reduce our own casualties, and to so limit logistics that the control of the population was facilitated. The Nam Can area where Seafloat was established was so isolated that it would have remained under Viet Cong control even after the infiltration had been cut way down. So we had to do that as well in order to recapture the whole Delta, which was achieved by the time of long before the fall of Saigon. That Delta was no longer a war theater, in essence.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you had to do both. But I guess if you force me to choose, I'd have to say that Sealord was strategically more significant. It protected the whole delta, whereas the Namkan Seafloat operation just retrieved a very resource-rich portion of the delta.
Mm-hmm. But I suppose it also had additional importance in terms of its value as something to demonstrate.
Yes.
Look at what we are capable of doing, and we can do this anywhere we choose to do it.
That's right, and it was so clearly an all-Navy operation, whereas in the other areas we did have support from the of the CIDG or the Army, and in Seafloat it was all us, mm-hmm. ships and boats.
Platforms, right. And to such a critical...
And it got Daniel Evans down to Seafloat, population settling along the bank of the river. His eyes just glistened. He was really thrilled by that.
Mm-hmm. When you first... let me ask you this, the actual site of Seafloat, What sort of thinking went into where exactly are we going to put this operation?
We wanted it to be the widest possible section of the river, consistent with being roughly in the center of that circular area. And so it was picked with that in mind. I don't recall whether or not we also gave consideration to part of the river would be the easiest to repopulate.
Mm-hmm.
But very soon we started looking at that after, and we may have a little ahead of time, I'm not sure.
After, I was there when we were making a selection, and the defensibility and feasibility of getting river that flows both ways in there.
About 9 knots of current at the maximum.
Right. Mm-hmm. And that's a lot of current when you're dealing with kinds of blunt
right.
floating objects. And the widest selection would give the most protection, but then the whole area looked like it was going to be difficult. And in fact, the Seabees told us they would have to start a tremendous island out there that probably doesn't exist anymore.
Paula Obi, was it?
I beg your pardon.
Paula Obi?
No,
is that the name?
Don't think so. It was a little further north.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, they were great.
And
they said it was going to take
tons and tons,
X thousand tons, and we said start moving.
Because I remember there's a great deal of message traffic on the movement of that sand, where the CB in charge of this would send messages directly to COM-4V saying that we had 7 barges today.
Right.
Barge 1 unloaded X tons, 2 X tons. If you average them out, we got this number of tons today, and then there are just dozens of pages like that.
We were watching it daily.
Mm-hmm. I mean, because you sent out an order in the message traffic saying that I want daily updates on the progress of this
right.
operation, and I want, you know, each message to include this, 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 and this, including a comment from the CB in charge of what he regards as the progress of the day and what is the next task.
See, we knew that the Army was just drooling to see us fall flat, that as a senior advisor was.
Mm-hmm.
And we knew that he was betting pretty heavily that we were going to get overrun. And I wanted to show progress just as fast as possible with regard to resettlement, so that General Abrams would then see that this thing really needed for the daily.
The amazing thing, I think, that I see in this is the logistics challenge of setting it up, because the original operations order is in the file, and it's about 16 pages long of small print.
Right.
This command will do this, this command will do this, this command will do this, and I just don't run in this manner.
Yeah, they executed. McNichols and his boys just did a great job.
Mm. And in terms of the location, Seafloat itself, was there the remains of a town that had been destroyed nearby?
Yes, there was. The old Namkan city that had been just bombed out of existence by us once the Viet Cong took control of that area.
In early 1968?
Yeah.
Okay.
I had not flown for 20 years in that area. I don't even remember seeing the ruins, do you?
I did on one occasion.
I mean, were they nearby when you fly over the site? Can you see where the town used to be?
It was within a mile of the site, as I recall. We walked to it. We took boat partway and then walked.
He did.
is that hard?
Oh, yeah. It's very good at it.
And the other thing that, that you see with regard to SeaFloat is that it's not just SeaFloat itself, but also something called the Annex. And I haven't seen that mentioned anywhere else, and I would be curious to know what that was.
My guess is that that was what we were talking about ashore.
Mm-hmm.
Do you recall it, Emmett?
I think that's probably what it was. Mm-hmm. That's where we got the sand so that it would,
okay. Well, you,
that would be the Annex.
So that you began constructing an actual more permanent base ashore,
yes.
From
the
SeaFloat itself.
That was the design all along, simply because of the difficulty of vulnerability of SeaFloat itself.
Mm-hmm.
It's possible to show the civilians that we were able to come ashore and stay. But the critical element was getting that sand in some 3 feet deep over, because the Army lost one, or we lost an Army tractor that said, oh, you don't need that much sand, and the next morning it was out of sight.
Sank down into the...
Yeah.
Was there a similar degree of attention placed in the problem posed by the Rungsat zone outside of Saigon, or had that been largely solved?
It had been largely solved, and then the Viet Cong made a major effort to reestablish themselves, and we started getting ships fired at fairly regularly, and that brought General Abrams immediate concern, because I mean, logistician, he knew that if they cut the major river to Saigon, that he'd be in deep trouble. So he took a personal interest in that at every Saturday weekly intelligence estimate update, the weekly woo. And I therefore, I not only shared his concern, but I knew that was going to be something that I was judged on weekly, whereas these other operations were not nearly that closely supervised. And so I made it a point to start getting the very top talent, and got in there with Captain Jerry Wages, who was then a lieutenant commander, I guess, who came from he grew up in the bayou area of Louisiana, and I knew he would understand operations in that area. And he got in there and he had a joint command. He had control of some Marines, he had control of some Army forces, he had helos. It was really an exciting command for a young officer, and he did it magnificently. And we gave him some SEALs, and they started getting very aggressive, and we knocked it off fairly rapidly. But for 3 or 4 or 5 months there, it was something that I was really concerned about, because General Abrams was concerned. Ship ever got sunk, but we had two or three ships that got hit
by rocket fire.
Right.
And that was one of the, I suppose, one of the focus of the operations of that area is getting rid of the cover on both banks through a variety of methods.
Right. And then being so aggressive in our probing operations that the Viet Cong were afraid to concentrate there.
Mm-hmm. One of the reasons I asked you that is that I saw an operations order for an operation in the Rungsat Special Zone, which was remarkable in its size.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I was wondering if that was the initial push to try and reclaim that, because it was not just an American operation, it involved Australians,
that's right.
Koreans.
That's right. I should have said that it was a combined command, because he did have foreign forces as well. And the first two or three times that we put major forces together that way, we had very detailed operations orders, because we had so many forces to coordinate.
Mm-hmm. It seems very similar to me to the not SeaFloat, but that region. That here is a spot of critical importance that just seems to have been given over to the enemy by default, because it's too difficult to operate there, because it's not.
That's right.
It doesn't have the same.
And it was the one piece of territory in the Delta over which the Navy had sole and exclusive command. That was our little piece of the jungle war.
Right.
SeaFloat we just sort of co-opted in Senior Advisor Four Corps' territory, but the Rungsat was ours by acknowledgement from the very top.
something you said in comparing the rung set with your other operations is that General Abrams took a very direct interest in the special zone simply because of the shipping channel,
right.
Because it was a logistic problem. And you said that the others were not as closely supervised. And that raises an interesting point in my mind of perhaps the relationship you have with the command is that they, is it a question of Abrams isn't regarding what the Navy is doing as is nearly important, or is Abrams trusting you to go out and get the results, and so he's not going to keep tabs on?
It was the latter.
Okay.
Because initially, every week I talked to him, he said, have you kept the Corps commander informed? Have you kept the senior advisor for Corps informed? And after about the fourth or fifth week, he stopped asking that question. He was getting good reports back from his guys in the Army, and his attitude was, let the son of a bitch run if he's doing the job, you know.
Mm-hmm. So there wasn't, it wasn't so much a problem then that, let me see how I can word this well.
One other point I should add that I'm sure helped, and that was that Admiral Veth had been 2 stars and I was there as a 3-star, so that I was at least equal to the commanders in 2 Corps and 3 Corps, mm-hmm. and I Corps. And I was senior to the senior advisor for Corps.
Well, that was helpful. Though,
yeah.
Yes. Relationship that you have with MACV. I've questioned you about that before, about how you work with General Abrams, but the new question has arisen in my mind of, in a place like MACV, where you have an enormous staff, where it seems, in a way, removed from the war, because here you are in Saigon in this modern air-conditioned compound, and there are a great deal of senior officers running around. How do you operate in that sort of an environment where maybe there's not the sense of urgency that you think is necessary that you might share with General Abrams, but does this get lost in a big staff situation like that?
Well, you know, I mentioned that book about General Abrams in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
I had not read that book at that time. It was written much later, but I knew of General Abrams' World War II record, and I knew what kind of a guy he was tactically. He was just a legendary tactician, and he bulled his way. He was Patton, bulling his way through Europe, doing all kinds of unbelievable things that were based on aggressiveness and surprise. And so I knew from General Abrams' reputation that he would personally support the kinds of things that I wanted to do. And I'm just sure that his staff was saying, hey, hold him back. But General Abrams chose to wait and watch, and when he saw the results, then he just stopped paying any attention to his staff.
Mm-hmm.
I made my bet on the fact that General Abrams was the kind of a guy who would support aggressive tactics, you know.
It's just a matter of his staff is not an impediment, that you and he can communicate
right.
with one another on another level, and you can sort of work around the inherent, I guess,
that's
inertia
right.
in a large bureaucratic structure like that.
Yeah, and the vignette I told you about General Abrams' comment about he was convinced that all the navies in the world were in alliance against the U.S. Army was his kind of way of making fun of his own staff, that I was having to come in and get him to overrule that bureaucracy when they were schizzling the New Zealand Navy or the Australian Navy or the Korean Navy.
And this is the Sorley biography.
Right.
General Abrams.
Right. Right.
Okay, I need to read that still. We've talked briefly about pacification programs, and you mentioned that one of the initiatives that was taken was the pigs and chickens. Another one was the construction of housing. How difficult, or even maybe how easy was it to sell this, considering that the focus had been before interdiction, sea lords, barriers, take the war to the Viet Cong, stop them from having this easy access into the Saigon area, into the Delta. What sort of a shift is it from that over to diverting resources, diverting logistics and so forth into construction, into people programs for the South Vietnamese Navy in order to make that a viable institution.
It was a natural transition that went surprisingly easily for several reasons. First, Admiral Chan saw intuitively, instantly, that my proposal there was the thing that would keep his people happily anchored with their families at these scattered bases along the Cambodian border. He knew that in their culture, the family was ranked far above country, and that being there, it not only was important for morale, but it meant that his guys would fight like tigers with the families to be defended in a way that they might not even fight so ferociously if it were just a base without their families. Second, our guys, American kids to do just to it, took to it as something that was great fun. It was exciting for them to see what they were doing in a positive way as opposed to the negative way of shooting up people and things. So that there was a great deal of interest that created all kinds of initiatives beyond things that we had thought of ourselves at headquarters. The Army, under General Mildern, who was their Army component commander, he was my equivalent. I was the Navy component commander, he was the Army component commander. And he got very excited about it because he could see that was establishing the perimeter that gave the Army space. And so he was delighted to make available what we needed without worrying too much about who paid for it. Mm-hmm. So we had a lot of things going for us. Once the concept was proven by U.S. forces, then we immediately had to turn ourselves to the attention of how we're going to make this a Vietnamese operation. And that made it so clear that you had to do the things that would make the families well sustained. That I don't recall any real bureaucratic issues. Do you, Emmett?
No, sir, other than some priorities on getting shipments in. And
yeah.
One of the things I saw in the newsletter was it a problem to find men in the Navy who had expertise in things like this? One of the examples that I saw was a young naval officer who had an animal husbandry degree from Texas A&M all of a sudden finds himself, you know, the manager of a program like this, and this is, of course, maybe something he'd never expected when he joined the Navy, is that...
And we were looking for experts where we could find them, farm kids.
By and large, volunteers.
Yeah.
In terms of coming to grips with ACT UP itself, and I realize this is a part of it, and looking at the records, it's very difficult to get an overall picture of ACT UP because the records are, because of the way they're organized.
Yeah.
It's hard to look at it and say, here's the master plan. And I realize that what this entails is we have X amount of time to create a Vietnamese Navy that we are comfortable can continue what we have started.
Right. Yeah, and it was in essence organized chaos because we were under constant pressure to reduce forces faster than was optimally efficient, and we just had to count on the initiative and leadership of every echelon, and it was there.
Mm-hmm.
There was an overall plan for ACT UP prepared by Chick Rao. You haven't run across that in the files?
I think I've seen parts of it. It seemed to change from time to time.
He probably has a copy of his original plan.
I would hope he would.
I can't say, certainly I can't say that I've seen everything they've got. I've got hundreds of boxes of documents, and we had to be very selective searching through their computer files as to what we thought would be representative enough to get the overall thrust of what it was that happened while you were there.
Was Cal helpful?
Yes, sir.
Good.
He's wonderful. He works personally with everybody who walks in there. He sits down with them and says, now, what are you doing? And when he found out what I was doing with you, he was much more directly interested. And he took me aside and said, well, we'll make you a official. You want to play by the normal rules.
That's great.
But it, real nice guy, and all the people who worked there are very helpful. But they still got bureaucracy problems.
Yeah.
For example, I suppose there are rules they have to observe with classifications on some of these things, and even though they probably don't need to be classified, they can't just automatically say, go ahead.
Yeah. There's a move afoot as a result of the Moynihan study that's reported out to speed up the declassification. Mm-hmm. My hunch is that in another 6 or 8 months, there'll be a directive out telling people to declassify stuff much more rapidly in terms of time. Right now, I think it's still 12 years. And I don't know.
From what I looked at, most of the NAV4V material was what was known as Group 4, ungraded to step every 3 years, mm-hmm. and was supposed to be declassified at the end of 12. But he told me it's misleading. It seems from looking at that it's automatic, but it isn't.
Yeah.
Because somebody still has to look at it.
Right.
So
that's your big problem. They're so short on personnel. Mm-hmm. The files are organized. Mm-hmm. They organize them by task groups because they can know the names of the towns or locations.
I walked in there with a whole list of terms that I want to see.
Yeah.
I want to see sea lords. I want to see sea float. I want to see barrier reef. And they're not filed that way.
Yeah.
They're filed by command. And so you have to be creative in how you get at them.
Yeah.
But the guy, he told me, at the end of the first day, I went up to him and I showed him what I had. I said, this is what I've looked at. This is what I want to take. And I said, can you look at it and tell me if it's okay? And he looked through it and he said, if it says Group 4 on there, you go ahead. Even though it's not, because it should.
Yeah.
And what he would do is when he got the boxes out, he'd just thumb through the file headings and see if there was anything in there that he thought was questionable. And he said, if it's Group 4, go ahead. If it's Group 2 or 3, you ask me.
Yeah.
And almost none of it's 2 and 3. I mean, I'd say 99% of everything I saw was Group 4.
Good.
And it's just a question of, apparently there's a law that they have to play by.
Right.
Even their computer database is classified, and you're not allowed to search through it. So an archivist has to do it for you. It's kind of frustrating in that regard because they are so shorthanded.
Yeah.